Welcome to Rings of Power Reactions. I'm Aaron, your host and fellow Middle-earth wanderer. Here you'll find reviews, reactions, and deep dives into the lore behind Amazon Prime's Rings of Power. To go deeper, come wander with me on my main podcast, Lore of the Rings. Visit ringspodcast.com or find Lore of the Rings on your favorite podcast player. Now, let's wander Rings of Power. I know you are a big fan of Lord of the Rings, just as I am. So I have something special to share with you. Imagine carrying a piece of Middle-earth with you right on your finger. Well, now you can, thanks to the incredible Lord of the Rings collection from Manly Bands. These aren't just any rings. These are officially licensed, meticulously crafted rings inspired by the legendary world of J.R.R. Tolkien. Whether you're channeling the wisdom of Gandalf, the elegance of Legolas, or even the mystique of the One Ring itself, there's a design in this collection that's perfect for you. On my finger right now is my personal favorite, the sleek Aragorn ring. For you, my fellow wanderer, I have something special. 25% off your entire Manly Bands order. Visit ringspodcast.com and tap the gold bar at the top. There you'll find an exclusive link and code that gets you 25% off your entire order. So whether you're in the market for a wedding band, a statement piece, or just something cool to show off your love for Middle-earth, don't miss out on this exclusive deal. Again, visit ringspodcast.com, tap the gold bar, and save that 25%. These rings are as timeless as the tales they represent, so order yours today. You might disagree, but Rings of Power just feels small. Small compared to J.R.R. Tolkien's works, small to Peter Jackson's films, and just small overall. Today we are reviewing Season 2, Episode 5, Halls of Stone from Amazon's Rings of Power. We're going deep into ring lore, Numenor's religious ceremonies, letters begging for help, and the vastness of Middle-earth as it's not portrayed in this episode. Welcome to episode number 176 of Lore of the Rings. My name is Aaron, and I am your host and guide to wandering Middle-earth. Thank you to Joan the Ishtar for sending me a few Dr. Peppers. I hope you and the kids are listening and learning more about Middle-earth. And a huge thank you to this episode's executive producer, The Old One. If you would like to support the show, head over to ringspodcast.com/donate. Now, let's wander. During this episode of Rings of Power, Durin III claims one of the Seven Rings, and changes begin happening under the mountain. In Numenor, King Pharazôn cracks down on the faithful. And in Eregion, Annatar manipulates Celebrimbor into agreeing to craft the Nine Rings for Men. Let's begin with the title of this episode, Halls of Stone. This phrase comes first from the ring verse that is printed at the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, quote, seven for the dwarf lords in their halls of stone. That phrase appears in one other line from Lord of the Rings. While the Fellowship of the Ring is passing through Khazad-dûm, Sam asks if the dwarves live, quote, in these darksome holes. Gimli, the only dwarf in the company, chants a song that takes over a page to print about the ancient history of the dwarves. In the song, the first dwarf, named Durin, walks the lonely world and gives names to its creations, and the first kingdom of dwarves is founded. Quote, a king he was on carven throne in many pillared halls of stone, with golden roof and silver floor and runes of power upon the door. But I have one more reference for you. In the first age of Middle-earth, as told in Tolkien's Silmarillion, Galadriel and her brother visit a kinsman, King Thingol, in Menegroth. There, Finrod was, quote, filled with wonder at the strength and majesty of Menegroth, its treasuries and armories, and its many pillared halls of stone. That was the inspiration behind the secret elven fortress of Nargothrond. So while Halls of Stone is so strongly connected to the dwarves and the Seven Rings, don't forget there is a small connection to Galadriel through her brother Finrod. Now let's take a look at what King Durin has been up to now that he lays claim to a Ring of Power. We might call it a Ring of Power, but it really just looks like a ring pop, one of those beautiful blue raspberry ring pops, but, you know, I digress. Remember, the dwarves had been living in darkness since the earthquakes caused by the volcano broke all their sun shafts. King Durin's number one priority is to find the light, and he is able to do just that, find the light. He gives a rousing speech, one of the more unique ones that Rings of Power has provided, but it's clear to see that the stone singers are out of work. Their ability to resonate and hear the mountain is no longer needed. Keep this in mind, more on that in a moment. We return to Celebrimbor, where a party has been happening to celebrate the completion of a side project, the Doors of Durin. You are probably familiar with the Doors of Durin. These are the beautiful silver-inlaid doors that Gandalf tries to open so the company can pass into Moria. The drawings are from Tolkien himself, and are printed in the book in the chapter A Journey in the Dark. Legolas and Gimli both exclaim in wonder and delight at seeing the doors, because many symbols unique to their races are on the doors. Quote, "There are the emblems of Durin," cried Gimli. "And there is the tree of the High Elves," said Legolas. "And the star of the House of Feanor," said Gandalf. And when Gandalf finally figures out the password to the doors, he says, quote, "Those were happier times." Apparently, the door usually remained open and hardly ever closed in the Second Age of Middle-earth. But I'm not satisfied with Rings of Power showing a little celebration in the workshop, claiming that these were those happier times that Gandalf mentioned. It falls so short of the deep friendship between Celebrimbor and Narvi, and the long years of collaboration they and their craftsmen shared. Instead, we are supposed to believe that they are friends, simply because they say so. It goes back to Elrond and Durin being friends from Season 1. They're only friends because they say so. This failure is one of the oldest in the book. They are telling, not showing. Show, don't tell, is such common advice for new writers. And Rings of Power does so much telling. Oh, we're friends because we say so. The rings have power because we say so. We are collaborating because we say so. In fact, most of these episodes are just characters talking to one another and not a lot of action, not a lot of storytelling, not of actual visual storytelling is happening. It is cheap story writing. Behind that, this show suggests that the primary collaboration between the elves and the dwarves was crafting the rings, not necessarily the doors or anything else. The doors are only a symbol of their collaboration and not the product of it. The seven rings are the product. As if these peoples had no other thoughts or friendships outside of potential plot points for the screenwriters to make quick work of. It makes these characters seem flat, one-dimensional, and outright boring. Annatar does some impressive name-dropping with Celebrimbor to convince him that there are some good men out there who deserve rings. He mentions Eärendil, Tuor, and Beren. All three of these men are from the First Age of Middle-earth. Let's take a look at these. Eärendil is actually Elrond's father. He was uniquely situated to plead to the Valar, the divine guardians of Middle-earth, for help against Sauron's master, Morgoth. He carries one of the three Silmarils in the sky as a star, and according to Rings of Power, was a friend of Celebrimbor. Tuor was son of Huor. He did great deeds against Morgoth's servants in the First Age of Middle-earth. Beren was the mortal man who, for the love of the elf maiden Lúthien, entered into Morgoth's throne room and retrieved one of the Silmarils from the Iron Crown, an accomplishment likely unachievable without Lúthien's direct involvement. Beren carried a ring from Finrod that eventually Aragorn would wear several thousand years later. So, nice name-dropping, Annatar. Although not all of these are distant names for him. In fact, in Beren and Lúthien's case, Lúthien actually humiliated Sauron by defeating him in battle and taking over his tower through her music. She sent him back naked to his master. So I'm really surprised that with a straight face he can say Beren's name. But I'm not really, because that level of sophistication is beyond what the scriptwriters could provide. We see that Pharazôn now wields the scepter, but even with all the power of the land, he is unsatisfied. In this short conversation with his son, he drops a few lore-interesting tidbits. He mentions the White Tower on Tol Eressëa as the gateway to the Undying Lands. Let's pause on this. The Undying Lands are the lands in the far west, across the ocean, where dwell the Valar and the highest house of the elves. Tol Eressëa is an island just outside of Valinor. Meneltarma is the highest mountain on Numenor, which has a flat plateau at the top and was considered a holy place for religious ceremony or meditation. Numenor in particular is directly connected with worship and religious adherence to Ilúvatar, the one creator god. Men could see the White Tower on Tol Eressëa, but Pharazôn is correct, as the Silmarillion says, quote, "At times, when all the air was clear and the sun was in the east, they would look out and descry far off in the west a city, white shining on a distant shore, and a great harbor and a tower. For in those days, the Numenoreans were far-sighted. Yet even so it was only the keenest eyes among them that could see this vision, from the Meneltarma, maybe, or from some tall ship that lay off their western coast as far as it was lawful for them to go." But the growing discontent of Farazon leads him to think the elves are mocking him. They enjoy immortality in the Undying Lands, while mortal man suffers the darkness of death. Let's jump to the scene of Elendil resigning his captaincy by order of Miriel. This scene betrays something that I think Rings of Power just doesn't understand about Numenor. The idea of a promotion or being promoted is brought up so many times, especially around Elendil. Just for kicks, I've searched for the word promotion in both The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion. You have 3 seconds to guess how many times promotion shows up. 0 times. Not one mention of promotion in the entire work. So why do the writers insist so much on the idea of being promoted? To me, it shortchanges everything that Numenor stood for, and reveals the deep misunderstanding that the showrunners have about Numenor. But I'm trying not to merely criticize without being constructive, so I turned to trusty ChatGPT, yes I know I did it again, to help me come up with some better ways. Ascend in honor and renown, elevate in wisdom and command, advance in stature and dominion. Those are decent, I guess, for AI-generated alternatives to promotion. However, I think a much more Tolkienian word would be power. What if Elendil said something like, "I see your power has grown"? At the same time, the sailors are very appreciative of the captain and say things like, "May the Valar protect you." This is alright. The Valar are the divine beings who have the responsibility to be the guardians of Middle-earth. But even this falls short because, as I mentioned before, the Numenoreans have a special connection with the one creator god, Ilúvatar. But in this Hollywood-written TV series, they seem just unwilling to explore that monotheistic relationship. At any rate, remember that Elendil is trying to be faithful, not just to his queen, but to the cause of those called the faithful. More on this in a moment. We're not done yet. If you like this episode, please leave a review and share with your friends. And remember to subscribe if you haven't already. We'll be right back. Are you ready to dive deeper into Tolkien's world? If you've ever struggled to read The Silmarillion, I've got just the thing for you. I've created a free guide packed with my best tips to help you conquer this epic book. Whether you're a seasoned reader or tackling it for the first time, this guide will make your journey through the first age of Middle-earth more rewarding than ever. Head over to ringspodcast.com to download your free guide today. Your adventure deeper into Middle-earth starts now. Visit ringspodcast.com today for your free guide. We pop back under the mountain, where Durin and Disa debate the merits of the Rings of Power. Disa says that using the rings feels like cheating. I really love this argument that she is making. Some nuance, though. Stone Singers and Resonating is a Rings of Power invention, as far as I know, but the idea of the Rings of Power providing some unnatural ability to the dwarves is in line with the idea of machine or magic, which Tolkien defines as, quote, all use of external plans or devices, instead of developments of the inherent inner powers or talents, with the corruptive motive of dominating. Hence, the rings turn the dwarves from something natural, like singing in harmony with the nature of the mountain, to something that, quote, makes their will more quickly effective. How did Tolkien describe the effects of the Rings of Power had on the dwarves? I have 2 answers to that. First, from the Silmarillion. Quote, the dwarves indeed proved tough and hard to tame. They ill endure the domination of others, and the thoughts of their hearts are hard to fathom, nor can they be turned to shadows. They used their rings only for the getting of wealth, but wrath and an overmastering greed of gold were kindled in their hearts, of which evil enough after came to the prophet of Sauron. And next, from Appendix A of The Lord of the Rings, quote, for the dwarves had proved untamable by this means, the means of the rings, that is. The only power over them that the rings wielded was to inflame their hearts with a greed of gold and precious things, so that if they lacked them, all other good things seemed profitless, and they were filled with wrath and desire for vengeance on all who deprived them. So the rings heightened the natural tendencies of the dwarves. While the rings would corrupt and dominate men, turning them into the Nazgul, the dwarves were resilient against such control. Instead, the rings increased the dwarves' drive for wealth. This greed became all-consuming, warping their desires and leading to obsession with gold and treasure. However, their greed made them easier for Sauron to manipulate indirectly, fostering division and conflict, often to the Dark Lord's advantage. So while they retained their independence, the dwarves' greed ultimately contributed to their downfall. And that is exactly what we see with King Durin in this episode. What begins as a good thing, finding the light, quickly slips to a sales tax called Ring Tribute, and soon Durin is surrounded by more gold than we have ever seen in Khazad Dûm before. Durin even calls emissaries of the other dwarven kingdoms to him, offering to give each a ring, but, quote, it comes at a price. This goes back to the Silmarillion again, quote, it is said that the foundation of each of the seven hordes of the dwarf kings of old was a golden ring, but all those hordes long ago were plundered, and the dragons devoured them, and of the seven rings, some were consumed in fire, and some Sauron recovered. Durin's ring is indeed kindling his greed, or as Elrond put it in the Council of Elrond in the Fellowship of the Ring, the desire for, quote, hoarded wealth. But I know that you are more generous than a dwarven king with a ring of power, because it costs you nothing to open your podcast app right now and leave a 5-star rating for the show. I would really appreciate that. Just scroll to the show in your podcast player, tap the review or rating, and let me know your thoughts. Do you think that Rings of Power is doing a good job showing the dwarves' greed here? Let me know. Back to Celebrimbor's workshop, where Myrdania has become invisible while testing one of the 9 rings. While invisible, Myrdania can see what is called the Unseen World. While there, she sees a fiery creature with dead eyes. Later, Annatar will lead her to believe that the creature is Celebrimbor. But I believe she is seeing Sauron in his unseen world form, yet he is able to redirect her. Even so, this scene is not so compelling, because they are simply showing, not telling. Why can't we see what Myrdania sees? Why do we have to see this through Celebrimbor's eyes? We could see both, actually, as Peter Jackson actually did when Frodo put on the One Ring. We could see what was happening outside as if there were no ring, but we could also see how Frodo's whole perception shifted. Everything changed for him. Why do we not get to see that in this show? Why do they insist on simply telling us, rather than showing us in a beautiful visual story? Anyway, let's go back to Numenor, where the ceremony of the faithful is taking place at what appears to be the feet of the great statue of Eärendil. This ceremony has several religious undertones, which may seem a little surprising to some. However, Tolkien once said that, quote, the Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. Nowhere in Middle-earth is the religion more overt than in Numenor, where religious ceremonies were loyally followed for many centuries, but in time were abandoned in mortal man's pursuit for immortality. A unique thing about the religion of Numenor, it was directly tied to the creator god Ilúvatar, and not necessarily the Valar. But notice when the priest says, quote, until we meet again in the far green country under a swift sunrise. That is a direct reference to a dream that Frodo had in the house of Tom Bombadil, and is indeed a reference to the passage of death. I explore that more deeply in Lore of the Rings, episode number 165, if you want to dive deeper into that. Also, the stained glass window behind the priest shows a golden tree and yellow orbs like the sun, but they also show phases of the moon. I take this as a subtle nod to the two trees of Valinor, Telperion the Silver and Lorelin the Golden, from which came the moon and sun, respectively. I find it interesting that there are 11 circles showing the different phases of the moon, when in the Silmarillion, Tolkien has the trees inversely wax and wane for 11 hours, plus one more where the light of both intermingled so that it was always light for a full 12-hour cycle. What about the little statue? First, I'm not aware of any idolic traditions in Numenor, but the statue is a direct reference to a member of the Valar. Nienna, quote, is acquainted with grief and mourning. In the song that created the world, Nienna's part was to sing a lamentation, quote, but she does not weep for herself, and those that hearken to her learn pity and endurance in hope. We might call her the goddess of mourning, and yet there's an element of beauty and wisdom in her sadness, quote, for she brings strength to the spirit and turns sorrow to wisdom. Nienna alone, with her tears and song, was able to wash away the darkness and filth left behind by Morgoth after he destroyed the two trees of Valinor. And partially due to her efforts, the Valar managed to rescue a silver flower that became the moon and the golden seed that became the sun. Before we leave Nienna, though, I need to mention one other being who learned, quote, pity and patience from the mourning of Nienna. That would be the Maiar spirit that is called Olorin, or you more likely know him as Gandalf. For more on Nienna and the two trees, check out episodes 2 and 5 of Lore of the Rings. This scene, for all its great callbacks to lore, has some dialogue that breaks the enchantment for me. Kamen starts to brag about being promoted. Again, the idea of promotion seems to be the greatest desire that any Numenorean could wish for. And even yet again, he's just telling us that he's been promoted. We don't actually see him get promoted. But thankfully, he's slugged in the face before he can finish that sentence. And if I remember right, this is also the first time in Rings of Power that the Kingsmen are referenced. So let's explore this for a moment. The Numenoreans at first had great friendship with the elves, including Gil-galad, the High King. But over time, some of the Numenoreans became jealous of the immortality of the elves and started to break away from that friendship. So in the Silmarillion, we find that, quote, on the one hand was the greater party, and they were called the Kingsmen, and they grew proud and were estranged from the Eldar, meaning the elves, and the Valar. And on the other hand was the lesser party, and they were called the Elendili, the elf friends, for though they remained loyal indeed to the king and the house of Elros, the first king and brother to Elrond, they wished to keep the friendship of the Eldar. Hence they called themselves the Faithful. The conflict goes much deeper than that, but that's good enough for now. And well, remember my theory a few episodes back that Kamen and Valandil were both potential contenders for the three Nazgul who would come from Numenor? Well, that theory at least is half wrong, as Kamen cowardly kills Valandil by stabbing him in the back. And finally, in Celebrimbor's workshop, Annatar's gaslighting and manipulating finally pays off, as Celebrimbor is guilted into crafting 9 rings for mortal men. Oh man, the gaslighting is seriously so strong, as Annatar is like, quote, be mindful that someone is not manipulating you. I do have to say, watching Annatar slowly poison and manipulate Celebrimbor this season has been a real treat. And kudos to Charlie Vickers, I think that's his name, for turning Halbrand into Annatar and really pulling it off. Yes, I know, a rare moment of praise for Rings of Power. But the lying doesn't stop there, as Annatar flat out denies having done anything to alter the 7 rings. In fact, in true neurotic narcissist fashion, Annatar throws it back on Celebrimbor, blaming the deceitful letter that Celebrimbor wrote to his king. Ooh, that Maya is nasty. Are you ready to dive deeper into Tolkien's world? If you've ever struggled to read the Silmarillion, I've got just the thing for you. I've created a free guide packed with my best tips to help you conquer this epic book. Whether you're a seasoned reader or tackling it for the first time, this guide will make your journey through the first age of Middle-earth more rewarding than ever. Head over to ringspodcast.com to download your free guide today. Your adventure deeper into Middle-earth starts now. Visit ringspodcast.com today for your free guide. Annatar provides him with 2 options: come clean or plunge head-on, as if continuing down a road of deception will solve anything. If Celebrimbor took a moment to think about that, perhaps he would have had the strength to resist, but the show must go on and the screenwriters have to keep writing the script, so he doesn't think about that. Annatar is too far entangled into his mind, just as Galadriel's dream in the Grove in Episode 1 foretold. Celebrimbor is duped into thinking that the 9 rings will atone for their mistakes, saying that, quote, the 9 must do more than bring aid to men. They must bring balance to the entire project, draw strength from the 3, and redeem the 7. What Celebrimbor can't realize is his own deception. The 3 rings were supposed to bring balance, but they did not. To his credit, though, Celebrimbor is not aware of the division and shaming that had surrounded the 3, unless he saw Elrond like a 5-year-old grab the bag with the Rings of Power and run out of his workshop at the beginning of Season 2, Episode 1. Nor is he fully aware of how greedy things have gotten over in Khazad Dûm. But he is at least distressed somewhat by the path he has chosen, but he sees no way out of it. A couple last things before we get to handing out wizard staffs. The Orc army has arrived in Eregion, but the timing doesn't quite add up for me. Elrond and Galadriel encountered the marching army some ways away from Eregion. Even though they are supposedly coming from the north, and the army is traveling up from the south, that doesn't really make sense to me. Anyway, geography mistakes aside, Elrond decides to leave Galadriel behind and do the next logical thing. Bypass the army and warn Eregion of the danger! Oh wait, no, he doesn't do that, because that would make too much sense. So he sends half his company to do that, and the other half to warn King Galad, and he valiantly stays behind to help Galadriel! Nope, can't do that either. In reality, he does what I think is the complete worst decision. Abandon Galadriel, and run with his whole company all the way back to Lindon to inform Gil-galad that the orcs are in Eregion, and to return with an entire army. So, no warning to Celebrimbor, no splitting up the company for multiple objectives, no helping a sacrificial warrior, but instead taking several days to run all the way back to Lindon, and apparently raise the army and march all the way back to Eregion before it falls to the Orc army that is literally just across the river. Oh, and don't forget that Durin, King of the Dwarves, somehow has sent out messengers to the seven Dwarven kingdoms, received emissaries from all of them that arrived at exactly the right time. Okay, perhaps they were like ambassadors just sitting around. And they have to go back to their respective Dwarven kingdoms to tell their masters about the Seven Rings, and then their masters have to come to Khazad-dûm to come get the Seven... But wait, it gets worse. Prince Durin, in the same episode, has traveled from Khazad-dûm to Eregion to have a little nighttime chit-chat with Celebrimbor, and then has made it all the way back to Khazad-dûm, and he also didn't even see any orc army around. Is there no distance in this Middle-earth? It took me to this episode to articulate one of my chief issues with the Rings of Power. Though I actually danced around it in my reviews of Season 1. It is so small. People fast travel from one place to another as if they were shrine hopping in a Legend of Zelda game. Distance has no meaning, and therefore time has no meaning. The world seems so small. Yes, they have these huge set pieces to look at, but even then we see such tiny places. Think back to the faithful turning in their soldier's gear where Elendil resigns from being captain. That scene takes place on some random street corner with a dinky little table. Linden apparently is a war room for commanders to meet, no more. Eregion is barely more than a workshop and a courtyard. Where are the vast, sweeping shots, like Gandalf climbing the seven levels of Minas Tirith after riding through several nights on the fastest horse ever known? Where are the vast landscapes, like Frodo and Sam lost in the dead marshes, barely trusting Gollum as a guide because they have to? What about the vast numbers of the Rohirrim, though they be less than half of what Theoden hoped for, as they ride to certain death in the hopes of saving Minas Tirith on the fields of Pelennor? Those things had scale, they had breath, that makes us feel like we are a small part in a much bigger tale than our own. But not Rings of Power. No, here we have a handful of elves, or tiny street corners, and no distance between peoples. Let's take Círdan, for example. Círdan, the great shipwright, the eldest elf in Middle-earth, who has been building magnificent, seaworthy vessels for literally thousands of years. Círdan has a tiny little dinghy, into which he sails a few yards from shore, in an attempt to drown the rings. Nearly everything in this show is so crammed and tiny, and it falls epically short, pun definitely intended, it falls epically short of the majesty of Tolkien's Middle-earth. Okay, rant over. I have one more lore item to point out. In Elrond's report to High King Kil-Galad, the king responds saying something like, "The elves cannot defeat Sauron and Adar, not alone." Now the keen-eared probably might hear that line and remember that Elrond will say something similar to Gandalf in Peter Jackson's Fellowship movie. There Elrond says that they cannot fight both Mordor and Isengard. Quote, "Our list of allies grows thin." But when I heard that line from Gil-galad, my mind went a little further. In a book titled Unfinished Tales of Numenor and Middle-earth, Tolkien gave us a little gem of a story called Aldarion and Arrendis, the Mariner's Wife. This tale explores the early days of Numenor's seafaring tradition and the establishment of some of their earliest settlements in Middle-earth. On a personal note, Aldarion is the heir to the King of Numenor, and yet he and his father don't agree on many things. However, Aldarion delivers a letter to his father, the king, a letter written by none other than High King Gil-galad himself. In this letter, Gil-galad informs the King of Numenor that, quote, "A new shadow arises in the east. It is no tyranny of evil men, but a servant of Morgoth is stirring, and evil things wake again." Gil-galad goes on to explain the plight of the elves, and then asks, quote, "Now I make bold to seek your help. If you have any strength of men to spare, lend it to me, I beg." He goes on to explain a gap in the mountains, what you and I will later know as the Gap of Rohan, where Aldarion could waylay the enemy approaching from the east, should the King of Numenor assent to help them. Perhaps that's too much detail, and I think Rings of Power will attempt a different solution to the elves standing alone, but at least in Tolkien's mind, High King Gil-galad recognized the threat of evil from the east and recognized his own inabilities and asked Numenor for aid to defeat this new evil arising. Alright, let's do some scoring. Story, I find issues with the timing and the scale, but I also am gripped by Annatar's manipulation and the Kingsmen versus the Faithful conflict, so I'm going to give this one a 2. Characters, Durin and Disa seem on the right track, and King's Durin greed makes sense, but Elrond just makes some really stupid choices, so 3. Dialogue. Some wins and some losses here, I'll give it a 3. Visuals. 3 on this one. I just wish we got more show storytelling rather than just, hey, we're going to tell you that certain things happened. I'm going to tell you I got promoted. I'm going to tell you I saw this fiery spirit. How about you actually like show us these things rather than just people talking on screen? Music. The hurried horns that quickly provide Elrond's theme as he runs through the forest. That was pretty epic. But Elendil's theme, what we might call the theme of the faithful, softly playing as Valandil obeys him and shows mercy to Cayman. Not to mention Galadriel's theme as she's revealed in Adar's cage at the end. So some good storytelling through music in this one. I'm going to go with a 5. Lore faithfulness. I struggle with this one every time. The faithful in Numenor and their ceremony and shrine were big pluses, even though it was worship of the Valar rather than Iluvatar. But the idea that the 9 rings were made as atonement for the others is just so outside anything Tolkien wrote about. But also showing how quickly the Ring of the Dwarves turned Durin to greed, that was good. So I think I'll go with a 3 on this one. Overall score, 3.2, which is the lowest score that I've given this season. Join me in the next episode where I'll be breaking down the lore of In Rings of Power Season 2, Episode 6. That is, unless I get to the analysis of Tom Bombadil's song or the opening credits before then, but we'll see. Thank you again to this episode's executive producer, The Old One. If you would like to support the show and hear your name called out on a future episode, please visit ringspodcast.com/donate. And as always, thank you for wandering Middle-earth with me today. My friends, if you enjoyed this episode, let me know by subscribing, leaving a review, and sharing with your friends. Follow me on Facebook or Instagram at Lore of the Rings Podcast. For feedback on the show, please email me using the link in the show notes. Until next Thursday, remember, not all those who wander are lost. Are you ready to dive deeper into Tolkien's world? If you've ever struggled to read The Silmarillion, I've got just the thing for you. I've created a free guide packed with my best tips to help you conquer this epic book. Whether you're a seasoned reader or tackling it for the first time, this guide will make your journey through the first age of Middle-earth more rewarding than ever. Head over to ringspodcast.com to download your free guide today. Your adventure deeper into Middle-earth starts now. Visit ringspodcast.com today for your free guide.